10 past 8. The Morning Show with Greg Berg is next.
Support for the Morning Show comes from the Carthage College Office of Continuing Studies, providing graduate and accelerated certification programs in education to start or advance a career in teaching. Convenient evening and summer courses are designed for the working adult. More information is available at carthage.edu/grad. Support for the Morning Show also comes from Andrea's, a Kenosha tradition since 1911. A unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. And don't forget about Jack's Cafe. Andrea's, 2401 60th Street, online at andreasgifts.com. And we welcome you to the Wednesday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. We are going to be tackling a very important topic indeed for the first part of today's morning show. We are talking about, the plight of the mentally ill and their families, those who care for them, and those who want to see those who suffer from mental illness receive the best possible treatment and medical care. And the whole field, of course, of medical care, medical coverage, insurance coverage, is right now under a cloud of, let's say, confusion and uncertainty as we shift from the presidential administration of Barack Obama to this new administration of Donald Trump, and of course to a new Congress, as it were, as well. So what is likely ahead for those who suffer with mental illness and their families in terms of what is likely to be the legislative agenda of this new president and this new Congress? And what is it that we can look forward to with excitement, and what is it that maybe should cause us worry? That is what we're going to be talking about today, and it is the topic of a very important event coming up later this week on Friday, January 27th, when the Kenosha County chapter of NAMI, the National Alliance on Mental Illness, we'll welcome someone from NAMI National, Andrew Sperling, Director of Federal Legislative Advocacy. Mr. Sperling is with us via telephone, and Jack Rose, who heads up the local Kenosha County NAMI chapter, is with us for the first few minutes here in the studios. We welcome both of you to the morning show.
Thank you very much, Greg.
Happy to be here, Greg.
Thank you for making time for this. So, Jack Rose, tell us about the nature of this event, which is coming up on Friday morning, and why it was scheduled and why you have issued this invitation to Andrew Sperling.
Well, I think everybody is aware of the change that we are going through right now, and having known Andrew for a good number of years, we thought it would be just a great community service to have Andrew come to the community and over at UW Parkside and just talk a little bit about, you know, what the new Congress and new presidency means to people with mental illness and their families. And this really came out of an idea from the Kenosha County Mental Health and AODA Services Committee. At our last session, we were talking about the changes that may take place. Nobody really knows what that is going to be. But with that, we thought this would be a great opportunity to bring Andrew back to Kenosha. Andrew has been here a few years ago and made a presentation at Parkside as well. So we thought it was a great opportunity. The timing was right. Andrew could make it, and so here we go.
Mm. And I know, Jack, from the many conversations that you and I have had over the years, that this is an aspect of the whole experience of the mentally ill and those who love them and want the best for them, this whole matter of accessing care, accessing medical care, treatment, medication, whatever it might be, and that this is an ongoing battle that has been going on for a long, long time, and in a sense a battle that continues to be waged on all kinds of different fronts. Just say a word on the local level about how important this has been to you.
Well, I think it's critical, and I think we're making good progress here in the area, and it's been a truly collaborative effort between the Kenosha County Human Services, the local affiliate of NAMI. We have programs that we've started that have also reached out to the community. We have a very strong crisis intervention team training program, crisis intervention partner, and these are all collaborative efforts between NAMI, the Kenosha Police Department, the Kenosha Sheriff's Department, and Gateway Technical College and Kenosha County Human Services. We need to have this collaborative effort, I think, to reach out. And the whole purpose is to improve mental health awareness in our community. And in doing so, I think we're making good strides in improving the access to that treatment. If you look at mental illness, it touches 1 in 4. Many times people with severe and persistent mental illness, only 4 out of 10 get access to treatment. So we're trying to improve that.
Jack Rose is the head of the Kenosha County chapter of NAMI. And as I said, joining us via telephone is Andrew Sperling, who is coming back to Kenosha at the invitation of our local chapter of NAMI to speak this Friday morning at the University of Wisconsin Parkside in the Student Center Cinema. Jack, I want to make sure we ask you before you have to leave. Can people just show up for Friday's event, or otherwise how can they reserve a place?
That's correct. Just go ahead and show up. It has a capacity of 300 people in the cinema there at the Student Center, and so we hope we fill up for the event, okay?
Very good. We hope a lot of people will take advantage of this. Jack Rose.
Mm-hmm. And if they have any questions on this, any of your listeners out there, please give me a call at 605-9038, and we'll do our best to answer those questions.
Very good. So, Andrew Sperling, again, you are the Director of Federal Legislative Advocacy for the National Office of NAMI. I would love to know a little bit about how you first became part of NAMI, and if your intense interest in this topic springs from anything in particular.
Well, I do have a loved one, a brother in California who lives with schizophrenia, so that's part of the motivation for me working at NAMI. But I also, my experience is not as a clinician. My experience is as a legislative advocate. I spent a number of years working in the Congress on Capitol Hill for several members of Congress, and that's sort of where my experience is not on the clinical side, but rather on the legislative advocacy side, working through the process in Congress, trying to work with members of Congress to pass bills, legislation, implement policies that will be for the benefit of people living with disorders such as schizophrenia, bipolar disorder, major depression.
Hmm. I read when you started at NAMI, and I can't remember now. I feel like it's either been 10 years or 20 years. I can't remember now. I mean, close to 10 or 20 years.
It's been a while. It's been 20.
20 years. Okay. I wonder if you could just say a word about the nature of the work you have done for NAMI National over the course of these 2 decades. I guess I'm kind of asking, what was that work like? What sorts of challenges were you confronting in the early going versus the challenges that you have faced more recently and are likely to face now in the next several years?
Well, it's been a remarkable journey over the last 2 decades of what NAMI has been able to accomplish in terms of legislation and policy. We've had a number of landmark bills and pieces of legislation that we've gotten through the process. Probably the biggest was what took us close to 20 years was a law that we got passed in 2008 at the end of the Bush administration that requires health plans to equitably cover treatment for mental illness and substance abuse disorders. We call that parity. And so it's a coverage condition. If you offer coverage for mental health and substance abuse benefits, you have to do that on the same terms and conditions as you do medical surgical coverage. So it's asking health plans to cover treatment for schizophrenia on the same terms and conditions as they do heart disease or diabetes, which means they can't impose a separate higher deductible or have higher cost sharing or impose numerical limits on the number of inpatient days or outpatient visits. This was an enormous step forward, and it was a very bipartisan bill that was supported, not just signed by President Bush, passed by a Democratic majority in both the House and the Senate, and was supported actually by employers and health plans who wanted to do this. And it was an important bipartisan accomplishment, and we built on that in the Affordable Care Act.
What was necessary to make that happen? Maybe another way to say it is that, at least to a lot of us, this seems like the most obvious thing in the world in terms of just being fundamentally fair and making all the sense in the world, albeit, you know, perhaps it's something that was costly to implement. It means a cost to somebody, but it certainly feels fair and sensible and logical. And yet it was not in place until this legislation was crafted and finally passed. What was most crucial to the argument that allowed this to finally happen?
Well, I think it was getting to bipartisan consensus, and it was really the most crucial part of this was getting the buy-in of legislators. And we had a number of members of Congress that pushed hard for this. Unfortunately, most of them are now gone from the Congress. But the late Senator Edward Kennedy, Senator Pete Domenici of New Mexico, who was a Republican, Senator Kennedy's son, Patrick Kennedy, Congressman Jim Ramstead from Minnesota, it really took their commitment to see this through, and it was their, you know, accomplishment in pushing their colleagues day in and day out to try and get this done that really made it happen.
And I guess the heart of my question is, what ultimately did it take to persuade those doubtful of this? What really ultimately made the difference in for instance, you know, finding this bipartisan support? Was it just driving home the matter of just fundamental fairness?
It was driving home the matter of fundamental fairness, and it was also coming forward with actual, for lack of a better term, clinical evidence. In other words, it was making the case that these disorders, like schizophrenia, like bipolar disorder, are serious and have enormous costs associated with them, and that we have treatments that are effective. So there's no reason for a health plan to impose restrictions that they wouldn't impose on diabetes and heart disease or any other medical disorder. Making that really the scientific case that these illnesses are real and have enormous costs associated with them, and they need to be accurately covered.
Right. Did it come down to matters of practicality and feasibility, offering some kind of reassurances in the face of what might have been widespread fears about what this might cost, what this might mean, or was it more of a moral imperative that we're talking about here?
I think it was on the cost. I mean, we wouldn't have gotten the health plans and the employers unless, you know, they had their own data associated with how what the costs are associated with treating these disorders, and we had to make an economic case to them, and they largely knew the economic case. Because they know the burden it places on the health plans, and employers know the burden untreated mental illness places on their bottom line in terms of employee productivity, health care costs, and a whole range of issues.
Mm. So we are, in a sense, all better off when these kind of issues are adequately addressed.
Absolutely. Mm.
In the wake of the passage of that really important landmark legislation, what other legislation has been passed in its wake that has made a difference for the better in your mind in terms of the situation of the mentally ill?
We had a very important bill that passed actually in December, just last month, that's going to make a really important difference in a range of issues. This was a big package of bills that included something called the 21st Century Cures Act, which is designed to spur medical innovation and invest money in biomedical research. Tagged along with that bill were several other pieces of legislation, including something called the Helping Families in Mental Health Crisis Act. This was championed in the House by Congressman Tim Murphy from Pennsylvania, and it includes a whole range of changes at the federal level designed to modernize to modernize our public mental health system, largely focused on public health programs. So the what we call public sector mental health programs that are community mental health centers, state mental health agencies, to give them the tools and really to spur innovation and their approach to people. That system largely serves people not with a mild depression or but really people with more serious disabling forms of mental illness. And so there was a whole series of hearings that Congressman Murphy convened in the House, and this legislation passed with broad bipartisan support, and we believe is really going to advance policy, particularly with respect to public mental health service.
Hmm. Before we get to the matter of this new presidential administration and this new Congress, I wonder if I could just ask you a kind of a nuts and bolts question about the work that you specifically do, you and I assume some sort of staff that works with you in terms of doing this kind of advocacy. Generally speaking, what are your most important responsibilities in all of this? What do you do on a day-in, day-out basis? I mean, are you the guy knocking on congressmen's doors and hat in hand, you know, trying to have conversations with them? Or are you more of an orchestrator or a builder of policy proposals? What keeps you specifically busy?
Well, all of the above. NAMI is always working on new ideas and sharing them with our allies in Congress. But the strength of NAMI as an advocacy organization is certainly not me. When I go to visit a member of Congress or their staff, they know that I'm being paid to be there. What really matters to them is the fact that NAMI is a large organization. We have 1,100, close to 1,100 local chapters of the organization in all 435 congressional districts across the country in all 50 states. And so what matters to them is the fact that we have a local NAMI organization in that member's district. And they listen, they're not going to necessarily listen to me, but they will listen to their constituents. And that's what's most important, is engaging our members at the local level to then engage with their members of Congress, because that's who members of Congress listen to, is their constituent.
We're speaking with Andrew Sperling, who is Director of Federal Legislative Advocacy for NAMI National. He comes to Kenosha this Friday morning, the 27th of January, and speaks at the UW Parkside Student Center Cinema on the topic of what this new Congress and new presidency might mean for people with mental illness and their families. That is quite a question. And I suspect that, I mean, you're going to be speaking at Parkside for 3 hours. I'm not sure 3 hours will perhaps even do it. Maybe the first question to ask you is, to what extent can we even know what likely this new Congress and presidency will mean for the mentally ill? I mean, how much of this is supposition versus how much of what we know is based on some kind of clear objective account of what is ahead?
Greg, I will be the first to concede there is enormous uncertainty out there. What we do know is that the new president is what is at the top of his agenda, but this is expressed it throughout the entire presidential campaign, is really drawn enormous attention since the election, through the transition and now through the inauguration. That is repeal of the Affordable Care Act and replacement with a new a new system, if you will, an alternative to the Affordable Care Act. And that's, I think, where the uncertainty comes in, because he has not laid out a specific plan yet. And even when he lays out a specific plan, that's still going to be far from certain, because as we all know from our civics classes in elementary school, the president proposes, the Congress disposes. So he will have to get any alternative through Congress. And so there's a lot of work ahead in terms of defining what that replacement is going to be. And I also want to be clear on the repeal part of this. And I apologize for getting technical with your listeners, Greg, but it's a very important distinction to make. They are going to use a process, the Congress, and they're already underway. They've already passed what's called a budget resolution to allow this process to be in order. But they're going to use an expedited process under the Budget Act called budget reconciliation. And I apologize for that technical term, but if I could define it in its most simple terms, it's a process that allows the Senate to pass a bill with only 50 votes. And that's important because under the Senate rules, every senator is entitled to unlimited debate, and there's only one bill. In order to cut off debate, you have to have 60 votes to invoke what's called cloture. So we know that there are 52 Republican senators, so as long as there are sharp divisions between the two sides in Congress, between Democrats and Republicans, they would need 8 Democratic senators to vote for a bill under regular order. Well, they're not close to that, so they're going to use this reconciliation process, and it limits what they can put in the repeal bill. They can't repeal the entire statute. They can only repeal parts of it that are related to budget, to expenditures for mandatory spending and taxes. So it's likely that this repeal bill will include only those types of provisions. And they haven't written that bill yet. So there's still a great deal of uncertainty even about the repeal bill because they are using this special budget reconciliation process, and there are significant limitations, and any senator can raise a point of order and have a provision stricken out. So it's a complicated process even by which they're going to repeal this law. The deadline, believe it or not, is Friday, the 27th, for individual committees to report their portions of this bill. They're going to miss that deadline, and it could be several months before we actually see the repeal bill.
Right. Do you see a silver lining in terms of it being a complicated process, which might indeed make it then a slower process?
That's a terrific question. Yeah, and I think there are some advantages because it gives groups such as NAMI opportunities to engage with members of Congress in their local districts about what we want to see retained in the Affordable Care Act and also what we want to see changed. I don't think anyone would call the Affordable, even the most ardent advocates and supporters of the Affordable Care Act would not argue that it's a perfect law, and there's a lot of things that can be done to fix it legislatively and administratively, and we want to work constructively with the Trump administration and others to see that done. But there are parts that are very, very important to retain, and we're going to be talking a lot about that as well.
When you think about the gains that have been made that you do not want to see lost, so again, I'm not talking here specifically about the Affordable Health Care Act. I'm talking about the things we were talking about earlier. Do you fear an erosion of any of those gains? And if so, what would you want to defend most ferociously?
Well, certainly the improvements we've made with the Mental Health Parity and Addiction Equity Act, that parity law I was talking about earlier, that law had a number of, I wouldn't call them loopholes, I would call them sort of gaps. We were not able to get a requirement for health plans in the small group and individual market. So in the individual market, people buying their own policies, or the small group market, employers with 50 or fewer workers, parity did not apply for them, did not apply to those health plans. What we were able to achieve with the Affordable Care Act is because there was a requirement for all the plans and what's called the federally facilitated exchange to comply with the parity law, that brought equitable coverage parity to the small group and individual market. Because in many states, including Wisconsin, that the federal exchange absorbed that market and became that small group and individual market. So that was an enormous gain. So we don't want to see erosion of parity in the small group and individual market. That would be very, very important to retain.
So when you come to Kenosha this Friday to speak on this, what is your central message going to be?
That people living with mental illness and their families and people that care about these issues need to be engaged with members of the Wisconsin congressional delegation on what's important to them. And that would include, and with Governor Walker as well. The states will have an even more important role to play going forward. One of the clear things that we think the administration is going to be doing, at least in what Dr. Price, the new Health and Human Services Secretary, made clear at a hearing he was at last week. He has another hearing this week, is that they intend to devolve a lot of the decisions around health care and particularly the future of the Affordable Care Act to states. So Governor Walker is going to have a very important role to play here. in terms of how this is done going forward in Wisconsin. So it's engaging with your elected officials to help them understand the importance of retaining the parts of the law that are working really, really well.
Right. What has Governor Walker's track record been, at least in general, when it comes to some of these issues and questions?
He's been supportive. He has been. He's not been a fan of the Affordable Care Act, as you know, but on a number of other issues, he's been very, very helpful. I think Wisconsin has a pretty good public mental health system. He's been supportive. We hope that there's some opportunities in the new administration. We know that Governor Pence has talked about this, or now Vice President Pence, rather, about particularly with the Medicaid program, the need to give states more flexibility. We think there's an opportunity in the new administration for Wisconsin to do what 31 other states have done, and that's expand eligibility for the Medicaid program and reinstate some of the go back to some of the things that were done a number of years ago with, I think it was called Badger Care, where they were able to offer Medicaid eligibility to a large number of single adults below the federal poverty level. We think that the new administration would look toward, and they wouldn't have to change things in the Affordable Care Act necessarily to allow states to come in with their own innovative, what we call waiver proposals, where they expand eligibility through what's called a waiver, which where they're waiving the normal requirements in federal law under Medicaid, for Wisconsin to design its own plan that can work for its citizens. And we think the administration is going to open the door to governors to do that. We know that there was a meeting the day before the inauguration where a number of Republican governors met with the leadership in the Senate to talk about how they were going to handle expanded eligibility for Medicaid under the Affordable Care Act going forward, making sure that the 31 states that expanded eligibility will be able to keep their programs in place, and those that didn't might have new opportunities to come to the table with their innovative ideas.
We want to remind everyone. Go ahead.
Go ahead, Greg. I'm sorry.
I just wanted to remind people of your visit on Friday. Is there anything else you wanted to say?
No, just very briefly that the expanded eligibility for Medicaid is very, very important for NAMI as well. And again, with Wisconsin, not in this category, but the states that did this, with both Democratic and Republican governors, there's a large cohort of individuals with mental illness that didn't have coverage before and now have it under expanded Medicaid eligibility.
We can look forward to further exploration of these and other matters in your visit on Friday morning. That's Friday, January 27th, 9 a.m. until 12 noon at the UW Parkside Student Center Cinema. And this is an event sponsored by the Kenosha County Chapter of NAMI, the National Alliance on Mental Illness. This event is free and open to the public, and no reservations are necessary. You can simply show up on Friday morning and hear from Andrew Sperling, Director of Federal Legislative Advocacy for NAMI National. Andrew Sperling, thank you so much for making time for this conversation and for sharing your thoughts on these really, really important questions. And I thank you again for joining me today on the morning show.
Thank you so much, and I'm looking forward to coming to Kenosha again.
It's 8:38, and you're listening to the Wednesday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. Part two of the program is coming up in just a moment. A quick reminder that tomorrow on the morning show, something very, very special. My guest on tomorrow's morning show is Captain James Hawkins, who is the commanding officer for the Great Lakes Naval Base. And he happens to be born and raised in Kenosha. And we talk to him tomorrow on the morning show. For part two of today's program, out of the archives, a conversation with Mary Roach, the author of an intriguing series of books. This particular conversation is about a book called Packing for Mars, The Curious Science of Life in the Void. So did anything in particular prompt your examination of this topic?
Yes, I found out about this rather bizarre place called the Bedrest Facility. It's in Galveston, Texas, and it's a place where NASA simulates the effects of zero gravity. weightlessness. And they do this by having people lie in bed 24 hours a day for 3 months. They basically put on your PJs and don't take them off for 3 months and don't get up, don't even sit up, not once, for anything. And this is that they're trying to mimic not having any weight on your bones and not using your muscles and studying how the body begins to basically dismantle itself. You know, on a Mars mission, you're talking about you could lose up to half of your bone mass because your body's going, you know, we don't seem to be using this anymore.
Maybe you don't need it.
We can use the resources on something else. So anyway, the notion that there's these people being on the NASA payroll to lie in bed and watch TV and play video games kind of intrigued me. And then I started finding out about other elaborate simulations here on Earth, and I realized you could almost go into space without ever leaving Earth.
And it's really incredible. I mean, all that we never stop to think about that is involved, and of course this whole matter of what does it take to live and thrive in the environment of space. One of the things that struck me again and again is how remarkably people manage to sort of put themselves inside this unprecedented question. I mean, for all the mishaps and mistakes that got made in the early days of the space program, I am impressed with how much they were thinking about some of these matters more than I expected.
Oh, yeah. In the early day, it's right after World War One when rockets first, they started out. They were a way of delivering bombs quickly. No one was thinking about rockets as a way to send man into space. And then these guys, these scientists, were like, well, hey, we could use these things to put a person up into space. And then they began thinking, well, what will happen without gravity? And they were these elaborate scenarios. They thought that their blood would just churn in place, that it wouldn't circulate. They thought the organs would change shape, stop functioning, that the vestibular system would go completely nutty and that people would not even be able to see because their heads would be spinning so fast. A lot of hand-wringing went on back then, but they were really determined to try it. So there was this era of sending, launching these enormous V-2 and Aerobee rockets with one little tiny rhesus monkey way up at the top, and he's all wired up, and they're like, he's okay, I think he's okay. So it was, and then moving on to the chimpanzee era where, Alan Shepard and John Glenn both had been sort of beaten into space by chimps because the space agency just wasn't comfortable sending up a human being and without doing one dress rehearsal with one of the little hairy guys. So it was quite a protracted era of absolute anxiety about what will the lack of gravity, because gravity, it's one of the fundamental forces of the universe. You don't mess with that. People just didn't know.
Well, and getting back to the whole matter of, for instance, loss of bone mass when we are seated and still for such a long period of time, as, for instance, a human being would be on a long journey to the planet Mars. One of the things you suggest is that the studies indicate that right now, if we were to send a man or woman to Mars, it's very likely that if and when they stepped out of the capsule, their legs would break. I mean, from the impact of a simple step onto the surface of the planet. I mean, and one just shudders to think about what that would feel like. I mean, not only for the astronaut, but I mean, what that would feel like for the space industry, for a moment that should be one of triumph, to be completely undone by a mishap like that, unanticipated.
Yeah, right. When the whole world is watching, you step down and there's this ominous crack. Probably, it would probably be more dangerous when they come back to Earth, where you have Earth gravity. Mars, you have a third of the gravity, so you do have a reduced load. So they might be okay on the surface of Mars, but certainly when they came back, they'd have to really watch their step. And the countermeasures that we give them, exercise. I mean, the astronauts do like 2 hours of exercise to try to combat this degradation that happens. And I heard it would be about from a third to 50%. Loss of bone mass on a Mars mission, which is that's the equivalent of going into a wheelchair.
Hmm.
Yeah.
Among the many fascinating tests that you tell us about in your book, I mean, tests to ascertain the suitability of a given candidate to go up into space, one of the first we learn about is something called the Thousand Cranes Test. Tell us who administered this and why.
Sure, that was in Japan, the Japanese Space Agency, Space Exploration Agency. They were choosing new astronauts for the astronaut corps, and I came and watched for a day. They had the 10 finalists in an isolation chamber, and the test that they gave them, I didn't know what they were going to do. There were these sheets of paper, colored paper, that each astronaut candidate had, and they had to fold origami cranes. Each one did 100 cranes, and they had to string them along on string. And then these strings were given to the psychologists to examine. And they were looking, sort of comparing the early cranes versus the last cranes. Did the folds get sloppy? Was the person able to focus on this repetitive task? And at first I was thinking, what does this have to do with space? But you have to bear in mind, space has changed a lot from the days of the Mercury 7 and the Wright stuff. It's now, there's a lot of tedium and a lot of repetitive chores, and you want somebody whose accuracy isn't going to diminish under pressure. Like, you know, you've got a time pressure, which is similar to a spacewalk. You've got to get your task done before the time runs out, before your oxygen runs out. The task may be very repetitive. So in a way, it was a brilliant little test, not something you can really picture John Glenn or Alan Shepard doing, but it was the way that they'd come up with to look at these people's various traits and talents.
You underwent, I think a series of different tests, but one of them involved the encroachment of forces on kind of our mental facility. I think that might have been something involving air or gravity being gradually decreased and questions being posed. Tell our listeners about that and what sort of happened. I mean, and what was interesting as you describe it is how you thought you were fine or felt fine, and yet when you look at the tangible evidence of the answers you gave to some of these very simple questions, it was clear that you weren't.
Yeah, they as part of my orientation to go on that weightless flight simulator, they put you in a vacuum chamber, which this is a chamber where you can pump out the air and create a box of outer space. In other words, no air at all. But what they did, they took us gradually up to about 25,000, the equivalent of 25,000 feet in this chamber, and then they had us take off our oxygen mask to see the effects of low oxygen on the brain. And it was amazing because you had this, you felt fine. You didn't really feel strange. It was a little weird. You knew that something might be happening. But they had a questionnaire, and they had some, one of the questions was, what does NASA stand for? And obviously, I've been researching this book for over a year at that point. I know what NASA stands for. And I look back at my answer sheet when I got out, and I had just written N. I gave up after N, and I moved on to the next one. Another one was, subtract 20 years from the date of your birth. That one just completely stumped me. 20 years, like 1959, 49, 39. How hard is that? Couldn't do it. Hmm. Left it blank, moved on. So just imagining what it's like. You know, if you were in space and you had a leak in your spacesuit, you'd be exposing yourself to that vacuum, and you very quickly would be in a lot of trouble.
Right. And, of course, at a moment when you would need every bit of your brains and experience to bring to bear on whatever the problem was, it would desert you. And that's so frightening to think about.
Oh, yeah.
One of the most basic things you learned in the course of your research, I mean, almost right off the bat, is that there's essentially two different kinds of astronauts. And until that moment, that had never really dawned on you. And I think for most of the rest of us, that doesn't dawn on us as well. Tell us about that distinction. It really is important in understanding a lot of what you write about.
Sure. Well, I think if I'm like most of us, my association with astronauts was forged during the Apollo era. And the Mercury era, where you think of them as these heroic, macho, fighter pilot, aggressive, virile types of people. who were able to, you know, take great risks and plunge into the unknown and go where nobody had gone before, and it was all very dramatic. And now we're in this era. We have been in this era for, you know, a decade or more of just of orbiting larger spacecraft, long-term missions, you know, 6 months to a year, and now that right stuff is absolutely the wrong stuff. You don't want to be working with somebody who's like very vain, very big ego, very fearless, very forceful personality. You want people who play well with others. So now that the list of NASA astronaut attributes, recommended attributes that I came across includes things like ability to form stable and quality interpersonal relationships, fairness, flexibility, sense of humor, ability to tolerate low stimulation and boredom. This was not a consideration back in the early days of space when we were sort of really tuned into the space program. So now you're as likely to be a nerd as a hero. You know, I mean, not that nerds can't be heroes. I'm a nerd, certainly. But I just was floored by the way it's changed 180 degrees.
We're speaking with Mary Roach. We're talking about her fascinating book called Packing for Mars, The Curious Science of Life in the Void. All right, so now we dig into some of the really most intriguing and interesting stuff in your book. And we should say, too, that this is all carefully gathered information. You're not making, I don't think, any of this up. And honestly, it's really interesting to think about some of these questions that we otherwise just don't give a thought to. For instance, the matter that you talk about in Chapter 14 called Separation Anxiety, subtitled The Continuing Saga of Zero Gravity Elimination. And how does that happen in space? One of the most important things we need to know right off the bat is the fact that excretion in zero gravity is a really tricky problem because we have none of the early warning sensations in that environment. Tell us why not.
Yeah, for the bladder, the human bladder, the way that organ tells you, okay, time to excuse yourself and go to the bathroom, is there's these stretch receptors, and as the bladder starts to fill, you know, with gravity, it's all down in the bottom of the organ, and it starts to, you know, stretch out the sides of the organ. Well, in zero gravity, and then the stretch receptors trigger the, you know, impulse in your brain to go to the bathroom. Now, zero gravity, the liquid is actually clinging by surface tension to all of the organ, sort of in a sphere. You have a bubble of liquid, so it's a lot longer before it starts expanding, you know, stretching out the bladder and telling you have to go. And it can be so extreme that your bladder, by the time you realize you have to go, your urethra is pressed shut from the pressure, and then you've got a little bit of a medical emergency. You've got to get out the self-catheterization kit, and it's embarrassing. So the astronauts are essentially potty trained. They're told there's a guy down at Johnson Space Center who trains them all, and he explains this, and he says, so, okay, you're going to set your clock, you're going to go to the toilet whether or not you think you need to. You're going to go every few hours, because you don't want to get into trouble, because your body's not going to let you know. And I found that fascinating. You know, I mean, I've heard, you know, you do a lot of tee-hee stuff about going to the bathroom in space, but the physiology was fascinating. He said same thing's going on with number two. You've got not the same sort of signals to the brain. And so it's amazing what astronauts, they kind of take these high-achieving, top of their class individuals and put them back in preschool in a way.
Well, right. Absolutely. And I'm sure Gus Grissom and Alan Shepard and John Glenn never thought that they would have to learn about fecal popcorning. It's just amazing the kind of things that end up being important. In Chapter 10 of your book, Houston, We Have a Fungus, you take on another matter, which is that of hygiene in space, and how do we or can we keep astronauts clean through the course of a long flight? Explain why this is even more of a challenge than we might first imagine.
Well, first off, you you don't have a shower. Because showers, if you have a nozzle with water coming out, it goes for a little way, and then it starts to form this just this blob of water. And the blobs, making matters worse, they tend to stick to the concave parts of your body, like your eyes, your nostrils, your mouth. You can really run a risk of kind of choking and drowning in the shower. So, I mean, there's a great description. One of the cosmonauts on Salyut had a description of, you know, what a strange sight it is to see a naked man flying across the room with a snorkel mask going to the shower. But very quickly they just abandoned the whole business of showers because, you know, they were constantly chasing down droplets of water, and the cleanup afterward was far more lengthy than the actual shower itself. And so they just switched to, you just wipe yourself. You've got little moist towelettes that you wipe yourself. But really, space is, it's kind of a backpacking, camping mentality. You're never going to be able to have a real nice, hot, relaxing bath or shower. I came across these amazing studies done just before Gemini where they had a space cabin simulator, and they were have these poor college students. They were putting them in spacesuits for weeks at a time, not letting them bathe, and then documenting the squalor, really, just like checking, you know, how far is the bacteria migrating, and how bad do their armpits smell, and can a human being stand this? And so they, Gemini was really, Gemini 7 was this restricted hygiene space mission where Frank Borman and Jim Lovell were up there, and they'd have these consults with the flight surgeon going, Frank, are you having any dandruff up there? Just like two guys orbiting the Earth talking about skincare.
We should finally just touch on the matter of food. And one of the things that's so interesting about this chapter, again, is how what we might imagine to be, you know, relatively straightforward questions and challenges just are not in space. And it's really an interesting history. And some of the scariest stuff is what happened in the beginning in terms of what they thought astronauts could and would want to consume in space.
Oh, yeah. In the beginning, they had all these, the food, because it's a little capsule, they had to be a lot of weight restrictions. They wanted, and space restrictions. They wanted something small. They wanted it bite-sized so there'd be no crumbs. You just pop it in your mouth. And they, for an extra measure of safety, they coated it in this sort of waxy, oily coating. The other consideration was they wanted it to be, quote-unquote, low residue, meaning very highly processed so there's not much to be excreted, because really the solution, with a space capsule, there's no toilet. You were going to the bathroom in a little bag. So the astronauts would try to make it the entire duration of the mission without using the dreaded fecal bag. So the food was actually designed to not generate a lot of residue. So it was very processed. They were very unappealing. Some of the astronauts just didn't eat. You know, there was a lot of weight loss going on because these little foods, like, you know, dehydrated bite-sized beef sandwich. Well, they're adorable to look at, but they were just hideous to eat. And you had to rehydrate them in your mouth with your own saliva. They were ghastly things, and they tended to fly into space and then fly back down again because nobody ate their full rations.
I don't remember if it was that or something else that you described as a digestive fiasco, but we can kind of chuckle about it now. But you really can't afford to have much in the way of fiascos in space. And I wonder, as we conclude here, if you found that in fact it was kind of a strange split brain experience to be writing lightheartedly about things which really are kind of funny and entertaining, and yet which are in many cases much more serious matters, especially for those men and women in space, than we might ever imagine.
Yeah, astronauts have a surprisingly robust sense of humor about this stuff. I interviewed Jim Lovell. He had been in, you know, he's the one who was in that restricted hygiene Gemini 7 where they were going to make them wear their spacesuits the entire 2 weeks. They took them off. They couldn't stand it. But he had an amazing. They just take these things in stride. Because I said, so you're sitting there basically on a love seat with another guy, and you've got to use this bag. And isn't that like this breakdown of human dignity? And you know, he's like, you get used to it. He said, after a while, you don't even turn away. You know, it's sort of this comic. intimacy that develops, and it's sort of a testament to how the human spirit can adapt to just about anything.
There's a moment when one of the early astronauts is quoted as saying something like, "You know, what a sight! what an incredible sight this is!" And I think that might have been Jim Lovell. And of course, you suggest that